Police at the Door. The monthly banquets of the Black Widowers were never models of quiet and serenity, but on this occasion things were unusually noisy. Where usually one or another of the members was in a testy mood and made his views known with remarkable vigor, this was one of those rare times when all the Black Widowers were remarkably vehement. It seemed next to impossible for any one of them to complete a sentence, or for any listener to determine who was saying what. "I tell you that when we have a pipsqueak dope runner like Noriega..." "Pipsqueak? Why worry about pipsqueaks? What about the situation in South Africa, where we seem remarkably adjusted to..." "Never mind South Africa. Panama's in our backyard." "You make it sound like Pennsylvania. It's a good..." "I'm talking about the Panama Canal." "The less we talk about how we got it in the first place, the better." "Look, all of you are missing the point. The drug problem is a matter of demand. The supply..." "What are the farmers supposed to grow? Coca plants are the only crop." "It's good old free enterprise, good capitalist doctrine." "Since when have you been such a yodeler on the mountaintops for free enterprise?" Arnold Chris, the guest on this occasion, listened gravely, his eyes traveling from one speaker to another. He had a round and chubby face that made him look younger than he was, and curly brown hair that showed no signs of thinning. The well-cared-for fingers of his right hand drummed softly on the tabletop, making way briefly to allow that best of all waiters, Henry, to place the chocolate mousse before him. Chris turned to Mario Gonzalo, host for the occasion, who, mindful of his hostly dignity, had contributed very little to the hot discussion. Chris said, "How long has this club existed, Mario?" "It was founded during World War II, before my time, of course." Chris said in a tone of deep envy, "You fellows must love each other." Gonzalo turned his attention to Chris with a look of wonder. "Are you kidding, Arnie?"
"Kidding? Not at all."
"Where do you get this love shtick? We're yelling at each other like crazy."
"But that's what I mean. No one's bothering to be polite. Everyone's saying what he wants to say without regard for anyone's feelings. You can't help but get the idea that there's complete trust among all of you. Everyone knows that nothing he'll say will in any way disrupt a friendship. That's love. Come on, Mario. Is there anyone here who wouldn't lend you money if you needed it? Or put himself out to help if you were in trouble?"
Gonzalo thought about it a moment, his eyes traveling from one squabbler to another. Then he said, "I guess you're right, Arnie. I can count on every one of them. But each one would be so sarcastic at my expense if I came to him with a sob story that I think I'd try out a handful of strangers first."
"You would not. You'd go to them like a shot."
Chris turned his attention to the chocolate mousse. As the members were drinking their coffee almost immediately afterward, or in the case of Chris, herb tea, Gonzalo rattled his water glass with his spoon. "Gentlemen of the Black Widowers," he said, "you've all met my guest, Arnold Chris, and you all know he's a cellist with the Philharmonic, probably the best cellist it has had in at least 30 years.
"What is this?"
interrupted Thomas Trumbull indignantly, the lines on his tanned forehead turning it into a washboard.
"Are you doing the grilling yourself?"
"What I'm doing," said Gonzalo, "is eliminating some of the things there's no point in talking about." Geoffrey Avalon, hunching his thick eyebrows low, interrupted in his turn to say,
"I don't think you should do any eliminating, Mario. I have some questions I'd like to ask about the internal workings of the Philharmonic."
"Maybe we'll get to that," said Gonzalo. "But I'm the host, and I'm using host's privilege to turn the discussion in the direction I think proper. Arnie Chris, as I was about to say, is a celebrity." At this, Chris twisted uncomfortably in his seat and said,
"Not really, Mario. I don't have the kind of following the Beatles had, or in fact that any third-rate rock star would have."
"Among people like us, you're a celebrity," said Gonzalo, "and that's all we care about. So we'll take all that as given. Now it's customary for the host to appoint a griller, but I never heard that a host can't appoint himself as griller."
There was at once a tumult, and Emmanuel Rubin raised an indignant voice.
"It's never been done!"
"Just because something's never been done doesn't mean it can't be done, Manny. I'm host tonight, and I've got the right to run this banquet as I wish. And I wish to be the griller. I have some questions to ask of Arnie."
How can you be an objective griller? Demanded Reuben. You're a personal friend of the grillee.
So what? I still want to ask the questions. Host's privilege. James Drake peered through the smoke of his cigarette and said, Let's give Mario his way. When he's asked his questions, we can ask sensible ones.
I second those sentiments, said Roger Halstead in his soft voice.
Go ahead, Mario. Shoot.
All right, I will.
Gonzalo sat back in his chair and straightened his somewhat garish tie.
Arnie, he said, you're a celebrity among people who have taste. You've been profiled in the New Yorker, and you've played at a command performance at the White House. You've got it made. So what's the matter? Don't you have any friends?
Chris straightened in his chair and looked indignant.
Of course I have friends. What do you think? What kind of question is that?
It's a Mario question, muttered Reuben in a low voice.
Well, yes, said Gonzalo. One would think you have friends.
I'm a friend of yours. At least I like to think so.
But then why do you envy us?
Envy you?
During dinner, while we were all screaming our heads off, you said to me that we must all love each other, and there was envy in your voice, as though you had no friends who loved you in the same way.
Love? Halstead's glance went around the table. I wouldn't call it love.
But Arnie did, said Gonzalo. He said we had the complete freedom to yell at each other and curse each other without fearing anyone would resent it, and that that was love. So I want to know what's behind that, Arnie.
Nothing, said Chris, his voice rising in pitch. Don't give me that, Arnie. I told you the conditions of the dinner, and you agreed to them. We can ask you any questions within the bounds of good taste and human decency, and you've got to give a complete and truthful answer. Everything you say will be held completely confidential by us. That includes Henry, who is also a member of the Black Widowers.
Chris said uneasily.
Well,
Trumbull growled.
Go ahead, Mr. Chris. If you have something on your mind, you might as well spill it. You'll probably feel better.
Chris nodded.
All right. Maybe I will. I'm not sure how to put it, though. I've been in music all my life, child prodigy and all that. I can't remember anything but concerts and moving that bow back and forth. Don't get me wrong, I love music. It's my life. It's just that every once in a while I get tired. Not of music, but of musicians. I wouldn't want that repeated, by the way.
It won't be, said Gonzalo. I promised you that. Why are you tired of musicians?
Almost all the time, all I have around me are musicians. That's only natural, even inevitable. But their talk gets monotonous. They've got their special insecurities and jealousies. After a while, none of them has anything to say that I haven't heard 1,000 times before. I suppose it's that way in any profession that's deep enough to consume a person. Now, you Black Widowers are all what we might call professional men.
His eye went from one to another.
Mario's an artist, and if I remember my introductions correctly, Mr. Avalon is a patent lawyer. Mr. Trumbull is a code expert. Mr. Halstead is a mathematics teacher. Mr. Drake is a chemist, and Mr. Reuben is a mystery writer. No two alike, and that's good. Because if you were all chemists, or all lawyers, or all writers, I have a notion you'd get tired of each other a lot faster.
Halstead said, You know, Mr. Chris, you can seek out friends who are not musicians.
I do, said Chris energetically. I do my best to get away from them. It's why I value my friendship with Mario here. And about a year ago, I found something else, too. By sheer circumstance, I met a group of men who play poker regularly, and I accepted an invitation to join them. There are 5 of us now, and we meet every Tuesday night for the game. It circulates among our apartments. Every 5 weeks or so, the game is at mine, and the whole thing is an incredibly welcome relief. Sometimes there's an additional player or two, and sometimes one of us is missing, but there are 5 regulars, including, he added with satisfaction, me.
What kind of people are they? Asked Avalon. Not musicians, of course.
Absolutely not. In fact, Chris hesitated. Actually, they're working people. Salt of the earth and all that, but no pretensions to intellectual activity at all. We just play poker and talk about football and drink beer and tell funny stories. In a way, I don't fit in perfectly, and I don't play the best poker in the world. I lose more often than I win. But I can afford the losses, and they accept me.
They know I'm a musician, but I never talk about it. They may think I blow a penny whistle. For a few hours each week, I'm a man and not a musician. It's wonderful.
In that case, said Gonzalo fiercely, why do you envy us?
Because something happened.
Aha, said Gonzalo.
What happened?
Chris said, something peculiar that just messed up everything.
That's not informational. You'll have to tell us what it was that messed up everything.
All right, but it's complicated. I'll have to start by talking about my wife.
If you wish to do so, said Avalon, please do. We'll leave it to your good judgment to keep matters within the bounds of good taste.
There's nothing remotely involving bad taste that's involved, said Chris. My wife, Grace, and I married in middle life. I was 53, she was 47. She's my second wife, I'm her first husband. She has no children, and mine are grown up. We live together, just the two of us, in perfect harmony. We've stayed in love, and we simply do not quarrel.
Trumbull said, I find that hard to believe, Mr. Chris. I've never come across any couple that didn't quarrel on occasion, and that certainly includes myself and Mrs. Trumbull.
It depends on how you define quarrel. Grace and I are both articulate people, and we each have strong views. Sometimes those views compete, and we have no hesitation in letting each other know that. As you black widowers do at your meetings, we yell at each other sometimes. We wouldn't be human or in love with each other, for that matter, if we didn't. But when I say we don't quarrel, I mean that our disagreements are always kept within the bounds of decency and fair play. We don't call each other names, we don't throw things, we never use our muscles. And when we do disagree, we make up again before bedtime, as an invariable rule. I'm explaining this so you'll understand how shocking the thing that happened was.
Drake said, Wait. If your wife didn't marry until she was 47, it's safe to assume that she was living on some inherited competence or on some adequately paying job or profession. Is she a musician by any chance?
Chris grinned self-consciously.
Yes, she is, in a manner of speaking. She's a piano teacher, but not a concert pianist, you understand.
A social difference? Asked Reuben dryly.
Yes, in a way. Still, it makes for marital harmony if we keep each other on an even level. Having lived with her maiden name, after all, for 47 years, she has kept on using it with my thorough approval. We put both names on the door when we married, G. Barron and A. Chris. Her name on top because she has students coming to the door all the time.
Reuben said, Does it bother her that you are much more famous as a musician than she is?
I don't think so. She refers to it now and then, perhaps with just a touch of grimness, but you can be sure that I know better than to be too aware of it, or to refer to it.
So, what happened? Asked Gonzalo.
Well, about a month ago, we were watching television quietly, and separately. We have two sets in two different rooms, and can each watch without being disturbed by the other, because we have a sizable apartment and a well-built one. She was in her office with the door closed, watching Star Trek, a program she's very fond of. I was in the living room watching a Kate and Ally rerun. I was about 10 minutes into the program, so it must have been 7:40 p.m. when the doorbell rang. That's always unsettling, because no one is supposed to get up to the apartment without the concierge downstairs ringing us. Of course, it might be a neighbor or one of the building employees. I knew it would be hopeless to expect Grace to answer the door while she was watching Star Trek, so I heaved myself out of my chair, went to the door, and, like a true New Yorker, refused to open the door without asking who was there. There was no answer, so I opened the peephole and looked out, and I tell you I got a grade-A shock, because the hall was full of policemen as far as the eye could see. I opened the door at once, and there were 5 of them, 4 policemen and a policewoman. I looked at them blankly and said, What's going on, officers? The policeman in the lead said, in a kind of brusque official voice, We have information that there's a marital fight going on here. Well, I'm sure there are people who are capable of putting on a convincing display of astonishment when they're not, in actual fact, astonished, but I'm not one of them. I was simply astonished at the idea of being involved in a marital fight of a kind that needed police attention, and my astonishment must have impressed the police as genuine. A marital fight, I said, stunned. Here? In this building?
In this building, said the policeman.
Then you have the wrong apartment, I told him.
No, sir, he said. We were given the apartment number and your name. And, of course, my name was right on the door, staring at him, so to speak. My look of incredulity must have made the policeman feel impelled to justify his intrusion into our life. Our information is, he said, that you had a knife at the throat of your wife. Words absolutely failed me at the thought of such a thing between Grace and myself. No wonder there were five of them. They were expecting a maddened killer with a knife dripping blood. Suddenly I thought of the two television sets that were on. However, we both ran the volume low to avoid troubling the other. My own set was a murmur, and I couldn't hear Grace's at all through her closed door. And neither program had been violent. I checked that with Grace later. But by then it had dawned on me that I had better produce a wife in one piece. Grace hadn't come out to see what was going on at the door, so I called for her. "Grace," I shouted. She must have been reluctant to interrupt her watching. I had to call twice more, the second time in considerable agitation, for it seemed to me the police might begin to think I was bluffing, and that I had a wife on the other side of a closed door who was either unconscious or dead. But finally she came out, clearly in fine shape and good health. "What's the matter?" she asked, and then she saw the policeman, and asked it again with more urgency. I said, "Someone reported that you and I were having a fight, and that I was killing you." It was her turn to be astonished, and the blank surprise on her face was all the policeman needed to see the report was wrong. They turned away, and the man in charge said, "Okay, but we had to investigate the matter, you understand?" "Of course," I said, "you had no choice, and I thank you for trying to protect my wife." And they left. There was a silence, and then Avalon said, "Well, Mr. Criss, it was an unsettling experience, I'm sure, but there were no later consequences, were there?"
"Not of any definite kind, Mr. Avalon."
Halstead said, "Are you referring to indirect consequences, Mr. Criss? I imagine it must have created a stir among the apartment staff to have so many police charging up to your apartment. It must have spread among all the neighbors and required embarrassing explanations."
"I certainly offered none," said Criss stiffly, "and no one said anything directly to me about it. The story may have spread about a marital fight, but there isn't a person in the building who could possibly believe that I had been abusing Grace. We're well known as the Darby and Joan of the apartment house."
"No, that's not what bothers me."
Gonzalo said, "We're still trying to get to it. What does bother you, Arnie?"
Criss said, "It's the question of who informed the police, of course. Someone called the police emergency number, reported a fight between us with a knife, and gave them the apartment building, the apartment number, and my name. It couldn't be a casual troublemaker. It had to be someone who knew me."
Trumbull said, "Maybe so, but you know a great many people who know your name and address. One of them must have had a few drinks and then got what he thought was the very funny idea of sending the police to your door. There's no way of telling who it might have been."
"You're quite wrong," said Criss angrily. "As I told you, almost all the people I know are musicians, and none of them would do it. It's not that they're models of virtue, but they don't have that kind of mind any more than I have. Once they've stopped thinking about music, musicians are a spent force. Look, this is the sort of thing a musician thinks is funny. One of them will regale another by saying Isaac Stern was rapping his violin about one of Paganini's show-off pieces, and made certainly hit every note. He left no tone unsterned. Here's another. Two aspiring violinists had finally achieved their goal and were playing a duet at Carnegie Hall. Naturally, there was a good deal of nervousness, and one of them lost his place in the sheet music. He improvised desperately while trying unsuccessfully to locate the bar he was playing, and finally whispered out of the corner of his mouth to the other, 'Where are we?' And the other whispered, 'Carnegie Hall.' That's what musicians think is funny. Not one of them would ever think that sending the police to my apartment on a false alarm would be funny." Avalon said gravely, "It's my experience that people can't be categorized that easily. Still, it might be one of your fans, though I should think they wouldn't know your exact address, or that, even if they did, they wouldn't be so disrespectful as to try such a trick."
"I should hope not," said Criss. "Anyway, I'll tell you who I think it is. I suspect it's one of my poker buddies, maybe all of them."
And the lines of his face sank into depression.
"Why do you think that?" asked Gonzalo.
"No real reason, Mario, but they all know exactly where I live. They've been to my apartment often enough, and I told you I don't exactly fit in. For all my trying, they may still feel enough of something different about me to make them pull that trick on me. It makes me feel bad, very bad. I enjoyed those sessions, and now I can't.
Have you stopped playing poker?
Oh, no. We still play, but the pleasure's gone. I keep looking from one to another, wondering which one of them did it. I don't know how much longer I can keep it up. It's spoiled everything.
Drake said, Have you tried to face them with it? Maybe one or more will confess, and you can have a good laugh over it. If you can take the joke like a sport, then they may really accept you. You would have passed a rite of passage, I suppose.
But it's not my kind of rite of passage, said Chris impatiently. And I did face them with it, though not as a group. I thought that if only one of them had done it, he wouldn't like to admit it in front of the others. I took the opportunity of speaking to each one of them separately and mentioning what had happened in as jovial a manner as I could manage. Each one of the four told me it was a dirty trick and didn't show any signs of thinking it was funny. One of them must be lying, I suppose. At least one of them.
But I take it you get along well with them, said Halstead. You've been playing with them for some considerable time, and I assume they've never made a move to get you out of the game.
Never, said Chris.
So did anything happen recently that would have made one or more of them annoyed with you? Did you arouse their envy in some way?
Not on purpose. Of course, my apartment is somewhat better than theirs are, but not that much so.
Gonzalo said, You didn't boast about how much you get for a concert appearance or anything like that, did you?
Chris looked revolted.
Of course not. You know me better than that.
Avalon said, Well, let's use our brains. The particular practical joke that was played upon you, Mr. Chris, put you in the position of being a wife abuser. Is one of your poker-playing friends a wife abuser?
Not to my knowledge, of course.
Yes?
Steve is having trouble with his wife, not physical, as far as I know. He's been running around, I gather, and his wife caught him at it, so things are antagonistic between them.
I'm not a psychologist, said Avalon, but isn't it possible he'd like to beat up his wife, and rather than actually do it, he worked up a fantasy that you beat up yours?
Why me? Asked Chris.
Perhaps he was annoyed by your calm and pleasant married life. You might have boasted about that, Mr. Chris.
I certainly did not. But, of course, when they come to my apartment, I can't very well stop Grace from being pleasant and good-humored about the whole thing.
Well, there you are, said Avalon. Steve might have some dim idea of getting even. After all, these are not great intellects you're dealing with, Mr. Chris.
They're decent men, said Chris. I wouldn't like to think Steve would do it for any such silly reason. The suggestion is not proof, you know.
No, it isn't, admitted Avalon. But we're not going to get proof unless one of them confesses.
I wouldn't demand proof, said Chris. I'm not going to be reporting anyone to the police. All I want is to be satisfied in my mind who it was and why.
Reuben said, Just a thought. Are any of the four actually given to practical jokes? If any of them is given to pulling dumb stunts like this, they do it as a way of life. They wouldn't need reasons.
Chris was thoughtful. I can't recall that any of them ever told stories about practical jokes he'd played. Joe once palmed all four aces and let us play a game without them. Naturally, each one of us thought one of the others had the aces. And when Joe started bidding, we thought he might have them. He was able to take the pot with a nothing hand. As soon as it was over, he admitted what he'd done. We all gave him what for, and he never tried anything like that again.
Maybe not, said Reuben. But it shows a bent of mind, you know?
Chris shook his head. That's not at all convincing.
Look here, said Drake. The point is that policemen were involved in this, and it strikes me that not many people would try a practical joke that makes policemen, as well as some innocent civilian, the victims. You, Mr. Chris, don't see the humor in it, and neither, I'm sure, did the police. If they found out who made the false report, they'd have good motivation for making life miserable for him.
What are you driving at, Jim? Asked Avalon.
It just seems to me that whoever did it must be sufficiently familiar with the police to be willing to take a chance. Did one of your poker mates ever have a run-in with the police, to your knowledge, Mr. Chris? Would he be trying to get at the police rather than at you?
Nothing like that was ever hinted at, said Chris.
Then thoughtfully, Ernie has a cousin, I think, who's a policeman. He mentioned that once or twice, it seems to me.
Trumbull said, A relative in the police force would make it less likely that a person would play games with the police, if you ask me.
Unless, said Drake, Ernie doesn't like his cousin.
I don't think that's at all meaningful either, said Chris.
A silence fell around the table, and then Gonzalo said, Listen, Arnie, is there anyone at the poker table that you don't particularly like?
No, said Chris. They're all nice guys, or I always thought they were till the police appeared at the door.
Then let me put it another way, Arnie. Even if you like all four, isn't there one you like the least?
Well, said Chris cautiously, there's Ken. There's nothing wrong with him, really, but he's got a hoarse voice that grates on my ear. My musical sense, I suppose. I just find myself wincing a little sometimes when he talks. What difference could that make?
Because I have a theory, said Gonzalo, that dislike usually works both ways. You don't usually dislike someone who likes you, and vice versa. Like and dislike make themselves felt in subtle ways, even when you're not aware of it. If you wince at Ken, he's bound to wince at you, and maybe his dislike drove him to the deed.
I don't believe it, said Chris.
Avalon offered,
Well, we have managed to show that each one of the four has something about him that makes it possible he's the one who phoned the police. Steve has trouble with his wife, and may be jealous of your marital bliss. Joe has a tendency to engage in practical jokes, and may have done it to indulge in his caprice. Ernie has a cousin who is a policeman, and may have done it either because he is hostile to policemen or unafraid of them. And Ken may have done it out of a vague dislike of you. The trouble is that not one of the four motivations is anywhere near convincing.
Chris nodded.
That's it. So it ends up where it began. I can't trust anybody at the game, and my one non-musical recreation is probably gone. Is it any wonder I envy you six your stable get-togethers?
Not a six, said Gonzalo. It's a seven, and nobody has asked Henry yet. Can you make anything of this, Henry?
Henry, from his post at the sideboard, smiled paternally.
I'm not at all sure I can shed any light on the situation, but I do have some questions to ask, if Mr. Chris will permit me.
Go ahead, Henry, said Chris resignedly. Everyone else has been at me.
Henry said, Did the police know who you are, Mr. Chris?
You mean that I'm a well-known cellist? I'm sure they didn't. When Mario says I'm a celebrity, he's exaggerating, you know.
Did they address you by name or refer to your playing?
Not at all.
Your name on the door must have meant nothing to them, then.
That's right, I'm sure of that.
Henry said, And your wife still uses her maiden name on the door?
Yes.
When the police came, they said the incident had been clearly localized by address, apartment number, and name. Did they address you by name? Or did you announce your name?
They didn't use my name, and I didn't announce it. My name is right there on the door. They saw it.
But they saw two names, Mr. Chris. G. Barron on top and A. Chris on the bottom. Which name had been reported to the police?
Why, my name of...
Chris stopped cold. Exactly, sir. You have assumed it was your name that had been reported, but you don't know. No name was actually mentioned, either by the police or by you, or, I suppose, by your wife. So it may have been your wife's last name that was reported, not yours. Isn't that right?
Oh, my God, said Chris blankly.
What difference would it make, Henry? Asked Gonzalo.
Henry said, There doesn't seem to be any clear candidate for the role of having played this practical joke on Mr. Chris. Might there be one who would have played it on Mrs. Chris?
Chris groaned.
Of course, there is. There's someone who has been harassing Grace for years, since long before I married her. He phones her frequently. He sends her letters. He won't leave her alone.
Why? Asked Gonzalo.
Chris shrugged.
He was a fellow student of hers once. Harmless enough, but somehow he never grew up, I imagine. He seems to have been in love with her back then. I suppose he's never found anyone else, and she's his fantasy. He's always been quite harmless, so I didn't think of him in this connection. But of course it must be he. He knows Grace is married and resents it, and fantasizes her husband might be cruel to her, I suppose. How is it never occurred to me it might be her name that had been reported?
It is my feeling, said Avalon, that however seriously a male may intellectually accept the concept of his wife's equality, his feeling viscerally is that she is merely an appendage.
Chris seemed too abashed to answer, but Henry said softly, At least, Mr. Chris, you can go back to your poker game in full enjoyment.